Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along today, folks, and for Bonnie Glaser, who's going to address the Sydney Institute. I should also say thanks to the US Study Centre, who invited Ms. Glaser to Australia, and also to the US Embassy in Canberra, and we have the US Consul General from Sydney, who's very welcome here today. So I briefly introduce our speaker. She graduated with a Master's from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. She was has been an advisor to the US government in various areas of defence, state and intelligence. She's worked for the CSIS for a decade and is currently a senior advisor for Asia in the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the CSIS in Washington, and she's a frequent visitor to China and to nations that have a close relationship with China. And Bonnie Glaser is going to speak for us today on the topic of the US policy priorities and the rebalance to the Asia Pacific. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here at the Sydney Institute in this lovely building. Good afternoon to you all, and thank you, of course, to the consulate, the U.S. Embassy, and, of course, the U.S. Study Center for inviting me to be here, not only in Sydney, but to travel around your lovely country. And I very much look forward to it. I will be going to the I will be going to Melbourne and to Adelaide and to Perth. And one of the most really interesting aspects for me of visiting Australia is interacting with so many parts of your society here and understanding how you see the challenges that we face in the Asia-Pacific region, the U.S. and Australia together, and particularly how people in Australia view China. I, of course, am merely one individual. There's a deep debate in the United States, as there are in many other countries, about the emergence of China and what it means for the world. And so I'm going to talk today about the U.S. balance to the Asia-Pacific, but I will be focusing a lot of what I have to say today on the issue of China's rise. So, of course, as you all know, in November of 2011, President Obama announced that his administration would shift its strategic focus away from the wars in the Middle East to the Asia-Pacific, and was called the strategic rebalancing, but often came to be labeled the pivot to Asia. And what I would say is that rebalancing is probably a better term, even though our president seems to like the term pivot. He has used it himself. But the word pivot created some anxiety, in part because this policy is actually the strategy, if you will, was aimed at, in part, reassuring countries of the region. The United States is a resident power. We have deep and enduring interests in this region. We feel that the United States has played a stabilizing role here, enabled the great economic growth that has taken place in this region, contributed to it by creating contributing to the creation of an environment in which countries can focus more on their economic development and not have to worry about deep security issues. So the pivot, of course, suggests that not only that we could turn towards the region, but we might very abruptly turn away from the region. So in a sense, it's not reassuring as it was intended to be, and implied that we were turning our back on perhaps our European partners, which was not the case. But there were those fears in Europe. So if I use the term, what I do is I use it occasionally interchangeably, but I will focus on rebalance. And One of the things that, as I have been in Washington and watched, listened to the discussion of this policy and really observed its emergence, I would say that initially there really wasn't a comprehensive strategy document that guided the strategy. In fact, it's really evolved over time. We have seen come together a really multi-dimensional strategy toward the region that has not just the military elements that have seized the headlines in so many newspapers around the world, but also economic and security and diplomatic components. And so that's what I will focus on today. The National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, has spoken about the U.S. rebalance at least twice. The first time was late last year in my organization at CSIS. And one of the things that he said, which I thought was rather striking, was that before President Obama was actually inaugurated, that there were discussions among his advisors about what the priorities of the United States should be when the Obama administration took office. And there was a very early consensus that was reached that the United States has been very over-invested in the Middle East, in a sense, in an abnormal way, having been bogged down in wars there for the last decade, and that our interests were increasingly in the Asia-Pacific region. And so having been under-invested here, there was really a recognition that this would be a new priority for the United States. But in fact, I think that recognition was actually not very new. If you go back and read in 2001 the Quadrennial Defense Review that was released just after the September 11th attacks on the United States, but largely written before, there was also a recognition of the importance of the Asia-Pacific region to the United States and the need, if you will, to rebalance, although that phrase was not used. So I want to talk a little bit about some of these elements or components of the rebalance strategy, and I'm going to start by talking about the economic elements, which I think are really underappreciated, but really the economic element is a real driver of this strategy. By 2025, Asia is projected to account for almost half of the world's economic output. The United States, our top export partners, over the last decade, 9 out of 19 were in the Asia-Pacific region. And, of course, having taken office at a time when we were facing the global financial crisis and there was deep unemployment in the United States, President Obama recognized that this was a region where we have tremendous ties and export markets. And President Obama announced in March of 2010 that we would have a target to double exports to $2 trillion in 5 years. And I think that further highlights the importance that President Obama and the United States attach to really our economic relationship with the region. Initially, the Obama administration really did not have much of a trade strategy. And so that, again, underscores the point I made earlier. I think the dimensions of the rebalance have evolved over time. But now there is a great deal of emphasis on trade, not only globally, but particularly here in this region. And the centerpiece of the strategy is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where the United States, of course, with Australia and other Asia-Pacific economies, are working to create a new type of free trade agreement that is based on a shared commitment to high standards, to eliminate market access barriers to goods and services, and one that is based on respect of a rules-based economic framework. Now, there are, of course, many models, different types of free trade agreements, bilateral, multilateral, trilateral, that exist in this region. They are not by any means mutually exclusive. In fact, all can contribute in various ways to promoting trade liberalization and regional economic integration. There has been some worry, for example, in China that somehow the TPP is aimed at excluding China. This, of course, is nonsense. And very early on, senior American officials made it clear that if China, other countries, would like to adopt these standards and seek to bring their own economies and their own standards in line with the requirements of TPP, that China would one day be welcome to join. There are a couple of other of economic aspects of this policy that I'll just summarize quickly. There are, U.S. is increasingly involved in economic projects in the region. The Lower Mekong Initiative was an early effort that is continuing to grow, where we are trying to strengthen cooperation in the areas of environment and health, education, infrastructure development in the Lower Mekong region. We've recently established a new food security project in Burma or Myanmar. So this is another element of the economic component of our rebalance to the region. And of course, there are other trade endeavors in which we are engaged, the U.S.-ASEAN, what we call E3, the expanded economic engagement, designed to expand trade and investment ties between the U.S. and the 10 members of ASEAN are also, I think, very, very important. So again, underappreciated but very important driver of the Asia-Pacific rebalance strategy and very critically important for American interests. The second component that I'd like to talk about is the diplomatic element of the Asia-Pacific rebalance. And I will emphasize primarily China, but I will talk about briefly some of the other components. When I analyze the U.S. Policy towards this region and identify some of the newest elements of this policy, because not all of them are new. The U.S. has always been a resident Asia-Pacific power. We have lots of military deployed, of course, mostly in Korea and Japan, traditionally. But we haven't been a very active player in the area of multilateral regional institution building, particularly in the security field. Now, we've certainly been an active member of APEC, that's in Asia-Pacific economies, but the security institutions, we have historically emphasized more our bilateral security relationships. And indeed, the Bush administration did some thinking about whether or not to become a member of the East Asia Security Summit when it was first established. And a decision was made to sit it out, to be an observer and see how the organization evolved, and then determine whether or not there was an important role for the United States to play. Obama administration officials came in with a very different approach. They wanted to shape regional institutions, particularly in the security realm, to try and influence them and use them to work together with like-minded countries to address some of the growing security issues in this region. I could point to issues, of course, like North Korea's nuclear weapons, the maritime disputes that exist in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. So the East Asia Summit is growing, continue to develop as a platform. And so the United States, of course, is working closely with Australia and our other friends to promote a multilateral agenda in these institutions and make them more effective. The second diplomatic component is strengthening our alliances, and I'm not going to go into any detail here, but I think that everybody knows that the alliances still remain the core of the U.S. approach to this region. Very important alliance, of course, with Japan and Australia, Korea, the Philippines, Thailand. I think we continue to expand diplomatic coordination, security cooperation in many ways. The third element is forging deeper partnerships with emerging powers. And particularly, I would emphasize India and Indonesia in this regard. And the United States has been especially supportive of India's Look East policy. India's interests are growing in East Asia, and we very much welcome that. And there are many countries in the region that would like to see India play a more important role. We've now seen much greater coordination among the United States, Japan, and India, the U.S., and Australia and Japan and India. So there's been, I think, a growth of these efforts to work with these emerging powers and promote their constructive participation in the region. I'm going to talk at somewhat greater length about the fourth diplomatic element, which is the U.S. relationship with China and trying to build a constructive relationship with China, while I think I would say that the overarching goal of U.S. policy is to integrate China into the international system and to ensure that as China rises, that it behaves in accordance with what are widely held international norms and aspects of international law. The U.S. has a very, very complicated relationship with China. A lot of it is very positive. And that often doesn't capture the headlines. But increasingly, the United States and China share a lot of common interests around the world. And when our presidents sit down next month in June in California for their first meeting since Xi Jinping has become the general secretary of the party and the president of China, there will be much to talk about. And the fact that this meeting has been scheduled, initially they were supposed to meet in September on the margins of the G20, but this early meeting is a recognition that this relationship is the most critically consequential relationship in the world. Some people say it's the most important bilateral relationship. I frankly think we have many important bilateral relations. But this relationship is extremely consequential. And if the United States is to succeed in achieving the goals that we want to achieve globally in this region and promote our shared values and common interests, we have to get China right. There is a view that I have heard since I have come to Australia that some people think that Australia has to choose between the United States and China. And it's remarkable to look around this region and see every country has China as its number one trading partner. And many of them are our allies. It's not just Australia. It's Japan. It's South Korea. And it is very much in the United States' interest to have all of the countries in the region have a very positive and productive relationship with China. So it is certainly not the United States that wants countries to choose, though sometimes I think it is Beijing that puts pressure on some countries to try and get them to give preference to China's interests over their own sometimes. We have seen examples of Chinese pressure. As Chinese power grows, we have seen China put pressure on Japan, for example, in 2010. When the Japanese arrested a Chinese fisherman, and the Chinese tried to put not only political pressure but also economic pressure on Japan, and tried to limit the export of rare earth minerals to Japan, which was very, very risky move, I think, for the Chinese. And then we also saw this in the case of the Philippines, when there was a difference in the South China Sea last year over their disputed territories. And the Chinese, in fact, tried to quarantine the tropical fruits coming from the Philippines to the Chinese market. So it's really in, I think, the interests of all of us that as China grows as a great power, becomes stronger not just economically, but certainly politically and militarily, that China is more integrated into this international system, that it doesn't think about its own interests selfishly. And I've been traveling to China for every year, more than 30 years, and my deep impression of China is that it is very much self-focused. Xi Jinping talks about the Chinese dream. The Chinese dream is not what, when I was growing up, the American dream was. You had a car and a house and provided a good education to your children. Yes, the Chinese want that. But the Chinese dream that Xi Jinping talks about is the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. The Chinese suffered what they refer to as the century of national humiliation, which began in the Opium Wars in the 19th century. And so they feel there are some wrongs that need to be righted. And as we even seek to accommodate some of China's interests, because indeed we should, we still have to understand that it is important for China to recognize what the interests are around the region and to not rise as a selfish power. There are so many ways that the United States is encouraging China to take on a more proactive role, to become more involved in security in the region as well as globally. Combating climate change would be an excellent example. Denuclearizing North Korea is another example where China has so much leverage over North Korea, supplying 85% of its energy and about 70-75% of its imported food. And so the United States and China are working together on these issues increasingly. And we are trying to encourage China to provide more security for the region, not only for itself. So I want to talk a little bit about the military component of the rebalancing strategy. And when the United States made a decision here to, with Australia, to deploy a rotational contingent of Marines, this was in part a recognition that we have been very concentrated militarily in Northeast Asia, as I mentioned earlier, primarily in Japan and in Korea. And so again, one of the really new elements of the rebalancing is not just rebalancing from the Middle East to the Asia Pacific, but from the northern part of the Asia Pacific to the southern area. And many here in Australia, as well as in Washington, talk about the broader Indo-Pacific region and the sea lanes that flow and connect the South China Sea into the Indian Ocean. So the U.S. has very important interests, as does Australia, in keeping these sea lanes open and ensuring that commercial traffic runs freely. And potentially, in a crisis, to ensure that the United States has access to this region. So that if we have to deploy more forces here in support of perhaps our ally Japan or perhaps our security partner Taiwan, if the Chinese were to use force, we want to be able to continue to have access for our Navy and our Air Force. We believe very strongly, I think, in freedom of navigation. And one of the elements of the U.S.-China relationship that worries me is this strategic competition. It's not the predominant element of the relationship, but it is part of this security dilemma, if you will, that the Chinese, as they grow, are defending their interests, and they take efforts, they take specific measures, such as developing a suite of capabilities that would make it difficult for the United States to really have access in a crisis. So missiles and stealth fighters and, of course, other kinds of surface ships as well as submarines. And it's an evolving capability. But from the Chinese point of view, yes, they are defending their interests. And in fact, they call this a counter-intervention strategy. And so, of course, the United States it has developed and continues to develop ways to ensure that we would be able to have access to this area and operate in a crisis in support of peace and stability. And so this is an issue that, again, it's the security dilemma. You have one power acting in defense of its interests, the other reacts. And managing this competition, I think, is going to be very, very important going forward in the U.S.-China relationship. I'm actually quite optimistic about U.S.-China relations because I think that the bigger that China grows, the more that its interests are expanding outside of its borders. It was a very short time ago that I would go to China and they would talk about these layers of interests, and their immediate interests were only those with countries with which they had contiguous borders. That has evaporated. China's interests are global, in part because they are dependent on resources and minerals, which they, of course, import from countries like Australia. And so it is in this sense, I think, that China has a great deal at stake in its relations, not just with the U.S., but with all countries in this region. China understands it needs to get along with its neighbors and with the United States. But I do think that this is an area where Australia, as well as other countries, have a role to play to encourage China to continue to adapt the norms and practices and procedures that are clearly operating and dominant in this part of the world. because that would serve all of our interests. So, the military elements of our strategy also include the deployment, as we have already deployed 2 out of 4 littoral combat ships in Singapore, and U.S. forces will likely, in addition, have a rotational presence in the Philippines. So the broader distribution of forces, while maintaining our presence, of course, in Japan and Korea, and enhancing our U.S. presence in Southeast Asia, is an important part of the military element of the rebalance. And in addition, we are strengthening U.S. partners' capabilities. We want countries that have historically had weak militaries, and therefore potentially vulnerable to coercion and intimidation, to have more capabilities to defend their interests. And I would cite, just as one example, the Philippines, which we are providing some capabilities, so is Japan, to help the Philippines have better situational awareness, know what is going on around their borders, and to prevent the Philippines from being taken advantage of. I must admit that I think the Philippines is a bit courageous. It is standing up to China. It's a very small country with very limited capabilities. But there is a dispute in the South China Sea among 6 different parties, and the Philippines has actually brought a case to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea Arbitral Tribunal. And I personally very much support this. In fact, I was reading this morning that Japan has now come out in support of this this case as well. And Secretary Kerry has also spoken in support of the application of international law, including arbitration, to solve disputes peacefully and in accordance with international law. So I think this is a good trend. And I hope that whatever the outcome is, whether it is favorable to the Philippines or to China, and the United States government does not take a stand on these sovereignty issues. We have a very deep interest in how they are managed, but we don't take a stance on the sovereignty aspect of it. So the final element of the just military portion, before I close with a conclusion, which many of you may heard of, is the increasing of our Navy in this region by 2020 to be 60% of our naval presence. This actually turns out to be about an increase of about 22 platforms. It's still fairly modest. Chinese ships by that time will probably increase by 3 to 4 times that number. So the United States is certainly, we hope, will maintain the capability here to preserve peace and stability and to deter and dissuade any other country from using force to solve disputes. China is not the target of this strategy, although the Chinese often think that they are. But it's an element. It's a consideration. I think it has to be for all of us as we, again, want to make sure that China emerges in a way that is not to the detriment of other countries in the region or the world. The overarching goal is to win the peace. You know, we at CSIS conducted a study, which was actually mandated by Congress, and the Defense Department chose CSIS to do a study of our force posture in the region. And so one of the slogans of that study, although there's a lot more than just slogans in it, is that our goal is to win the peace. So finally, as President Obama said in Canberra, U.S. goals in the region are to sustain a stable security environment and a regional order rooted in economic openness, a peaceful resolution of disputes, and respect for universal rights and freedoms. To achieve all these goals, the U.S. really needs to have, as I think we do, a multidimensional strategy and approach. We are increasing our economic engagement and cooperation, strengthening multilateral security architecture in this region, enhancing our partnerships with many countries while continuing to strengthen our alliances. We're also seeking to use our soft power. And, of course, all of this in addition to executing the military rebalance, which is an important part of this strategy as well. So with that, I look forward to your questions and comments.
Many thanks. Thanks a lot. And so we come to questions and discussion. Once again, thanks to the US Embassy in Canberra, the US Study Centre in Sydney, and the Consul General and his staff, in particular Peter Gilbert in Sydney, for helping us set this up today. So we've got till no later than the top of the hour, as they say, for questions and discussion. You mentioned that in your visit to Australia you've noticed that there is a view here that a nation has to, the Australia, for example, has to choose between or give priority to the United States or China. I think that's probably a position in academic circles. I don't think in political circles you would find that. Mm-hmm. I think Prime Minister Julie Gillard and opposition leader Tony Abbott would hold the view that Kevin Rudd held, and before Kevin Rudd, John Howard held, that we can have a very strong, continuing strong alliance with the United States and a good relationship with China as well. But tell me about your visits outside of China, where you go a lot, but to the other nations. When you visit nations in the region, you would find, I assume, that the kind of concerns that are held about China in the United States would be reflected for different reasons in most of those nations in the region that are not China?
There's, of course, a broad range of views around the world about China and within countries, just as I expect there are in Australia. When I go, for example, to Japan, there's deep concerns about the shifting balance as China rises and Japan, if it is unable to rejuvenate its economy, has already slipped into number three, but perhaps might slip further. And so there is angst, I think, in Japan about dealing with China, being taken advantage of by China. I hear this also from Vietnam. But there are many countries around the world, and of course Japan is similar to Australia in the sense that it has a hugely important economic relationship with China. But I don't hear from the Japanese any concern about having to choose. They understand their security is very much tied up with the United States. Economically, yes, they are dependent on China. But at the same time, they don't see that there is a need to choose between one or the other. And I'm glad to hear that certainly in government, that's not the opinion here. But as I speak around Sydney and Canberra, I get lots of questions about whether the United States is going to be able to prevent an open strategic confrontation with China that would be very, very damaging, to Australia. So I can appreciate that concern. But I think that if we look at the nature of the economic relationships, we are all so interdependent and interconnected. The extraction industries that you have in Australia, the investments are primarily from American companies. And the fact that there's markets in China, we all benefit from that. So it is very much, I think, a win-win-win type of arrangement. And so I think that I hope that China will begin to see the world, and particularly this region, in less of a zero-sum type way. We should all see security in positive-sum terms because we all face so many of the similar challenges.
Down the back, yep.
I've seen recently that the new Chinese leadership is looking to open up cooperation with India, whereas prior to this has just been border conflict. Is that something strategically, the US has looked at, and any expectation about how that might develop?
Question about China-India relationship.
Yes, the Chinese-India relationship has been growing for some time. India really looks at China as its most important trading partner as well. In fact, a potentially, in some ways, a growth model. They like the fact that China's been growing for double digits and would like, in some ways, to emulate it. There continue to be sources of tension in the relationship. China's continuing very close relationship with Pakistan is one. The continuing border tensions, although I believe that if you examine the recent case in which there was incursion along the border, you can see that the mechanisms that were put in place by China and India over the last decades, confidence-building measures, mechanisms that mandate that both sides get together and talk when there is a security concern, they're actually used very effectively. I would like to see more of those kinds of mechanisms implemented between China and Japan, between countries, for example, in Southeast Asia and the South China Sea, that could help to manage and diffuse some of these disputes if they were to escalate. So I think China and India have actually done pretty well in managing their differences and promoting their relationship. I don't know off the top of my head the figures of what the trade is, but it's increasing substantially. And so they have an important relationship that they continue to nurture. And China, first and foremost, really prioritizes having peaceful relations with its neighbors. And the only country that they have a serious remaining land dispute with is India. The others are far less volatile, I think. And, of course, there's the maritime dispute. So the relationship with India is very important to China.
Question, then?
Yeah, you were talking about the movement of military resources from the Middle East to Southeast Asia. Of course, we can observe that the large concentration of U.S. military resources in the Middle East has not been very successful. And the last time they had large concentrations in Southeast Asia, we had the Vietnam debacle. So are we about to see, with the arrival of those U.S. forces, provocations which will lead to potentially serious problems?
Oh, goodness, I hope not.
Well, we all hope not.
Okay.
I think that the United States is first and foremost working together in partnerships with other countries here. You know, we're not coming in just to defend our own interests. Obviously, we are putting in place budget cuts. We recognize we're not going to be able to defend security by ourselves, and it's very important for us to work with other countries. There's no country in this region that would want us to come in and start provocations and wars with other nations. I would also say that the United States is rather war-weary. We've had enough, I think, in the Middle East. I wouldn't call it a total failure, but it has certainly not been a success. And we aren't, of course, we're not completely pulling out of Afghanistan. We have important responsibilities there as we continue to train Afghan forces to be able to maintain some kind of peace and build a government there that has credibility and can promote economic development and stability in the country. So I think what the United States does here is going to be very much a shared effort with countries in the region, and I don't think, in my expectation, that it will be destabilizing.
Especially.
The one area where the United States and China probably have the most to gain from working together is North Korea, and the influence of the Chinese on the North Koreans. Why has there not been more, I suppose, success there in terms of pressurizing the North Koreans through the Chinese?
That's such an important question, so I'm glad you asked it. I think that the United States and China want to eliminate the nuclear weapons in North Korea. We have very different approaches to how to do this. Though I have to admit, the U.S. approach isn't working well, and neither is China's. So this is actually a moment for our two countries to think through what else we might do together. Now, the Chinese are very fearful of instability on their border. And there are some ways in which they could use their leverage over North Korea. They could perhaps cut the delivery of fuel, for example. But this is not something that China wants to do. It agreed in 2003, when we first set up what were called the trilateral talks and then the six-party talks, yes, we will work on, together with you and other countries, on achieving denuclearization under the precondition that we don't upset stability in North Korea. And China's policy has been no war and no instability and then no nuclear weapons. Eliminating those nuclear weapons has not been the highest priority. But I truly sense in my conversations with Chinese officials, military officers, and scholars that there is a rethinking going on in China. Because this young leader, Kim Jong-un, came to power in North Korea, and they expected, because he was educated in the West, that he would be more inclined to implement economic reform, that he might somehow slow down the nuclear program, at least it wouldn't be the top priority. And they see this young 30-year-old leader as being very defiant to China, not appreciating this relationship. And I'll tell you, from a Confucian angle, they also talk about we're the elders and he's the younger and we're not getting respect. But again, it creates this opportunity for the U.S. and China and South Korea, critically important player here, to try to shape some new future on the Korean Peninsula. The Chinese understand North Korea is a strategic liability for China. It is unpredictable. It is not contributing to security in the region. And so maybe we will be able to find some new ways to cooperate against this new background.
Going here and then here.
Historically, the relationship between Russia, China, and Japan has been a great source of friction. Does Russia have a role to play in rebalancing?
The U.S.-Russia relationship has been pretty complicated and not one that I focus a lot of my attention on. Of course, early in the Obama administration, we did achieve a new strategic arms limitation reduction agreement with the Russians. There's been a lot of tensions in the relationship. But Russia, of course, has an important role to play in the region. And I'm sure we continue to work with Russia on a range of issues. The Russians are now talking with the Japanese about the possibility of some resolution to their territorial dispute. And that would be certainly very welcome. And I think what the U.S. wants to see in terms of these territorial disputes is more models of peaceful resolution and management by countries. Russia and the United States are not, I believe, at loggerheads in the Asia-Pacific region. The issues that we disagree about are somewhat different. Russia, I think, has good relations with most countries in this region. Of course, we welcome that.
Isn't another element of what's happening in North Korea also the humanitarian side, such that China and Russia share a common border with North Korea, such that if there is a war, the refugees will spill over into the borders of Russia and into China, and therefore it becomes also a humanitarian question for both China and Russia, which is why I think that they haven't, they've held off from coming down too hard so far in North Korea, because there is that humanitarian side, whereas Japan and the U.S. will not face any of those humanitarian issues with what happens to the people of North Korea.
Well, absolutely. I think the humanitarian consideration is very critical for China and probably for Russia as well. The Chinese do worry that instability in North Korea would spill over into their borders, into northeast China. And as the Chinese prepare for potential instability in North Korea, they think about what they would do about those refugees and how they would potentially close the border try to manage that security situation. That's one of the areas where we really hope in the United States and also along with South Korea to have a conversation with China. If we were to face instability in North Korea, we would want to be able to address these humanitarian issues. We would want to get food to people in North Korea, get medical assistance. When there's total chaos, people start to migrate, as you say, towards borders, and more people die, more people get sick. And if you can talk in advance about how you would work together to get food into certain ports and distribute it through the system, and you have to create this, and then you would perhaps use local radio to send messages to people as to where these various food outlets are, where people could go. There's a lot of work that we could do in advance. And China's actually had a lot of experience in dealing with refugees recently coming out of Myanmar. So they understand what these problems are, but it would be so much more effective if South Korea, China, Russia, as you say, and Japan and the United States were to talk about these issues in advance. And then there's the even more sensitive issue of weapons of mass destruction in North Korea, the potential for unsecure facilities, loose nukes, if you will. Many of these facilities are very close to the Chinese border. And I know that the PLA is not eager to see U.S. forces going up along their border to secure those facilities. And so we would hope that that's what China would do, and that we would have other things that would be our missions and the South Koreans in cooperation with us. And so perhaps there could be collaboration, planning, even division of labor in support of stabilizing the situation in North Korea. And first and foremost, as you asked in your question, providing humanitarian assistance to the people.
Yeah, Bonnie, thank you very much for your insights. I wanted to ask about, well, it seems like it's been decades that we've had the South China Sea tensions over disputed claims for small islands. But the East China Sea, particularly the Senkakus, that seems to be something that's really come to the fore fairly recently. And I think Kurt Campbell on his way out said this was perhaps the most dangerous situation in the region at that time. And I just wonder, you know, what, obviously these huge economies are intertwined, but, and that's a positive factor, but, you know, what's the way forward towards a peaceful resolution of that crisis or that tension?
Well, that's a very important question, and I do share Kurt Campbell's concern about that. Because as an outsider, I can identify potential off-ramps, compromises for both Japan and China, but they are very much wrapped up in their own domestic politics, nationalism in their countries, unwillingness to bend to the other side. And the Japanese don't want to be seen as weak. They feel that they will be taken advantage by China if they give in. And the Chinese have already made gains in altering the status quo, you know, on the water, if you will, because they have effectively contested Japan's administrative control. They now have ships on virtually a daily basis that are operating very, very close to those islands. So China has set out as a goal that it seeks to convince the Japanese to acknowledge that a territorial dispute exists. And Japan refuses to do so. It does acknowledge that all of its other disputed territories are actually legitimate disputes. And so if the Japanese were willing to consider that, that might be a way forward. I sense so far under Prime Minister Abe's administration that the Japanese will not consider that as a possibility. But I think it's important for both governments to first resume their discussions on crisis management mechanisms, putting hotlines in place. These were started several years ago, and they now are pretty much frozen. Secondly, they should agree that neither country is going to try and occupy or build any structures on those islands, because that would be seen as very, very provocative, I think, by the other side if either of these countries did so. So those are two things. And then perhaps a way can be found to make these islands a national wildlife preservation area. They should once again, they need to find a way to shelve the disputes and recognize that they have a much more important economic, political, and security relationship.
I'm getting to the end, so I've got three, but I'm going to be very quick. One, two, three. We end with Simon. One, first, second, third. Yeah, very brief.
All right. Two questions, actually. Once we talked about the possibility to work on the North Korean issue between the U.S. and China, and then we talk about the Asian economy, about over 50% of GDP of global, that trend is continuing. Do you think America would consider to take a slightly different approach on defense and helping to contribute to global growth? Because last decade, two decades, probably not that successful, three or four. And then the second question is this, relates to Japanese support with the Philippines' claim of the Diaoyu Island or Chikaku Island. There are six countries were working on that. And it was really good to see that Japan and Taiwan actually having established standstill agreements, like what you said, make it a
I'm not quite sure what the first question is, but you know, if we can further strengthen the U.S. economy, we're going to contribute more to global growth. But we continue to do so in innovation and other ways. But obviously, we've had some of our own difficulties that we continue to grapple with. Cuts in defense spending or where we put our defense dollars, I don't think ultimately answers that question. It's our overall strength of our overall economy that I think the president is working on. I'm really glad you mentioned Taiwan as a player, not just in the South China Sea, but also in the East China Sea. And I think that the recent agreement between Japan and Taiwan is, again, one of those models for how you solve issues so that fishermen in both countries can have a livelihood and countries don't end up at war with each other over over these small islets. I worry about the recent dispute between the Philippines and Taiwan, where a Taiwanese lost his life. Again, I know that the U.S. is encouraging both sides to sit down, work out something like a fisheries agreement. But when you have these countries that have overlapping EEZs, their exclusive economic zones, these kinds of confrontations are bound to happen. And so I hope that all these parties can sit down and talk to each other and work out arrangements so that their people can go fish, so that resources, oil, natural gas, perhaps can be jointly developed, and so that they won't be a source of antagonism between these claimant states.
These very interesting discussions are reminiscent of 20-something years ago when we were focused exactly the same on Japan. Japan was had a new system where it was going to go on forever. Do you see China continuing on 5%, 6%, 7%, 8% growth forever? If not, what happens? Is that great?
Very important question. And of course, there have been many experts that have been predicting for some time that China's growth would slow down. We are finally there. But that's not to say that China's growth is going to stall by any means. The Chinese face a great deal of challenges, as of course the United States does. Different set of problems. The Chinese economic growth model has basically run its course. It has been investment and export-led, and now they are beginning to switch to a consumption-led growth model. And if they can do that and reform, financial reform, open up their capital markets, eliminate things like the resident permit system that exists in China, make their economy more competitive, allow these state-owned enterprises to be sort of, or force them to be more private and more competitive, I think China will continue to grow. The optimistic, I think, prediction for China's growth is that if China does the things that the leadership knows it needs to do, it could have, let's say, 7.5% growth for another decade. The negative forecast would be that if they don't implement the reforms that they that are being discussed, that within 5 years they could be growing at approximately 4%. That would be so risky for the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, which is why I'm very confident that that outcome is not going to emerge. Thank you.
Good. Finally, Simon Edwards.
Well, you spoke a lot about the physical conflicts in the region. Could you briefly touch on the significance and perhaps the unspoken challenge of cyber attacks that go on, particularly both militarily and commercially?
This is a new issue in terms of the public discourse, and certainly in terms of how the U.S. president and our senior officials are openly discussing this as a problem. And we just yesterday, there was an important report that was released by the former U.S. ambassador to China, John Huntsman, and former director of national intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair. And this is a problem that needs to be understood, I think, because it is Chinese like to say we're a victim like everyone else. Well, that is true to a certain extent. Lots of countries are victims of hacking, but briefly, I would say that cyber problem needs to be looked at in three different boxes. One is the issue of law enforcement. Everybody can get on board with preventing credit card fraud. We don't want child pornography. In fact, we have an FBI office in Beijing, and we work together with the Chinese on these law enforcement issues. That's not where the problem is. The second box is military espionage, where there's been a long, long history of stealing secrets, and that's going to continue. the onus is on individual countries to strengthen their defenses, to prevent their secrets from being stolen, but we're not going to stop that process from happening. There may be some efforts in the international community to set rules of the road and have some arms control solution to that part of the problem. I'm not personally not optimistic, but there, that discussion is underway. It's the third box, which you mentioned, of commercial espionage that we're very, very worried about. And it's not just the Chinese, but a large percentage of it is coming from China. And there's growing evidence that it is government-directed, and it's being implemented by parts of the military. Since our president is trying to reinvigorate the American economy and provide jobs for our people, we've actually begun to quantify how costly this is to the United States. And it's very difficult to convince the Chinese. You know, intellectual property is something you develop yourself, and you should be able to protect it. You should not be able to steal it. It's just against international laws and norms. And every Chinese that I speak to say, oh, you do it too. Well, you know what? The United States doesn't. This is not a government or military-directed program in the United States to keep American companies competitive. So I think that the Chinese are beginning, just slowly, to recognize this is a serious problem. And fortunately, more and more companies, and not just American companies, are speaking out about this threat. And so I hope that this is something that will be on the agenda when President Obama and Xi Jinping meet in California, because if we have some agreement at the very top that this is a problem, then I think the bureaucrats in China will begin to look for a solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bissot. Thank you very much. We're right on the top of the hour, and it's exactly the right time to finish. I know there are more questions, but we're all very busy. So, and we're right on finishing time. So, thanks to Bonnie Glaser for coming here today. Australia's got a great interest in the United States and a considerable interest in China. You've explained US policy in the region, and then in response to questions, you've gone through most of the key nations in the region and given your interpretation for what's going on there as well. So an important talk for us. It'll be on our podcast tomorrow. It's being filmed by the APAC channel on Foxtel. It'll be published by Anne and the Sydney Papers online shortly. So the talk will live on, but for now, thanks and well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.